musical linguistic
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Okay, I know it seems like almost every other podcast I have to warn you about the sound quality, so I've decided to only mention it when I do something for the first time. Like today's podcast, which is my first live telephone interview. For a first attempt, I guess it's not too bad, but I'll let you decide for yourself. And, yes, I do realize that there's a lot of room for improvement, so please don't hesitate to send your tips for improving these podcasts to Lorenzo@MatrixMasters.com, and I'll do my best to follow some of the good advice I've been getting. The recording I'm about to play is of a conversation that Sheldon Norberg and I had the other day, and Sheldon, as many of you know, is the author of a book and the star of a one-man play, both of which go under the title Confessions of a Dope Dealer. Now, how's that for coming out of the psychedelic closet, so to speak? I think you'll find Sheldon to be one of the more forthright of today's progressive drug educators, and I'm sure that you're going to find him both as interesting and entertaining as I do. When we begin our conversation, the first thing that you're going to hear me say is, it's kind of hard to miss that. Well, what I was talking about is that when I clicked the record button on the Gizmo project, which is the software I was using to record the conversation, there was this really loud voice from above that said the record feature had been turned on. Of course, that omnipotent voice didn't get recorded as well as the rest of our conversation did, so we probably sound a little like punch-drunk old fighters who were hearing voices in our heads. Kind of hard to miss that.
Yeah, that's different than the FBI one. They don't play that.
So, that turning on the record button here on the Gizmo Project lets you know that we are recording this.
Being recorded.
That's right. If only Big Brother would do this, huh?
Yeah. Did you see the news today about this Mexican informant guy?
No.
Oh, my God. Going straight to the White House. This informant that the DOJ had working out of El Paso was not only privy to, but conducted 14 murders.
Ooh.
While wearing a wire at this house where they were burying people and pouring quicklime on them in Jalisco, or in Juarez, right across the border. He would drive across the border, and they would ice these guys, lawyers and other, you know, drug runners and whoever, and, you know.
And yet he was a federal agent?
And he was, well, he was a federal rat. He was,
wow.
He was running loads for the cartel, for the Juarez cartel, and somehow got under the scrutiny of the Department of Justice. They did not tell the DEA this guy working there, and they all, and wound up almost getting a couple DEA guys and their families put in a hole.
Gee.
Who were, you know, working under the undercover under the border. But yeah, and it, you know, apparently the guy who oversaw it was the regional, you know, attorney general who was Bush's transition team director, who, as you know, direct line to Alberto Gonzalez, and the stuff had to be approved by the top level of the Department of Justice. So it's probably, you know, run across Bush's desk, or, you know, it's certainly within his circle of friends that, you know, they have this guy who is conducting murder after murder. Having called in and said, oh, we're going to go down and kill somebody now, you know, to his boss in the Department of Justice.
Jeez.
So, you know, advance notice, tape-recorded murders, one after another, and they still didn't, you know, pinch the guy that he was informing on. And then, of course, they finally figured out who he was and, you know, put him in a hole, too.
Well, you know, this whole war on drugs, war on consciousness is just... You know, the only people it makes sense to are the ones like the Bush crime family and all who are making money off this thing through the prison industry and the construction industry and the war industry and
exactly.
You know, and you know, it's just kind of strange that we're
money.
Yeah, we're living in strange times, to be sure. That about the only normal time I've experienced lately was back on the Playa last August, which is the last time I saw you, I think.
It was rather normalizing.
Yeah,
it was a particularly interesting time for me because I didn't use any substances other than some cholinergic memory enhancement formula that I took in the evening to just make sure I had my show down, make sure I was remembering everything so I could perform my show best. And that was the evening that was such a nice evening that no one showed up for my show, so I wound up packing it in.
But you know, that was the second show. The first show, you had a nice audience there. That
it was kind of weird because I had a guy lighting me with a flashlight from the front row.
So yeah, it was my flashlight. The guy was using.
Right, that was your old military flashlight there.
And he did a great job too. You know, he really worked at it.
Great job. Okay, that Burning Man, amazingly, without having used anything, was so synchronistic. It was like every time I was going to turn right and decided to turn left, there was somebody I needed to see or meet or had never met and wanted to meet me. It was really amazing. And when I was leaving and I had promised that guy, the guy who had lit the show from the front row, that I'd give him a book, and I packed up my whole truck except for one thing. I needed to go back into the big tent there and get my rolling chair. And I went back to get my chair, the last thing to pack up, and that guy was sitting in my chair, like, waiting for me, you know, 2 days later, you know, at that particular moment. I was like, hey, I've got a book for you.
You know, that's the way it's working out there on the Playa. That it's the little synchronicities like that are just amazing. Yeah, that and I really enjoyed your show. I know Dale Pendle and his wife were sitting next to me, and it was an interesting crowd, and I really got a lot out of it.
Thank you. It's so funny because I couldn't tell there was anybody there except for that guy in the front row who I'd never met in my life.
It was
my face, which is like, oh, I think this place is empty, but I don't know. There seems to be some people laughing back there, so I'll keep going.
Well, you know, if you've seen the aerial shots of the Playa this year, you'll see that tent was, I believe, the biggest structure on the Playa. It was over 6,000 square feet. So, you know, even with a few hundred people in there, it looked kind of empty. But there was a nice audience there, and I know we really enjoyed it over on my edge of the wing
there.
Yeah,
I kept hearing from people, you know, the next couple of days. Like, I saw your show. I was like, oh, really? Okay, great. Yeah.
Hey, you know, your show, of course, is of the same name as your book, Confessions of a Dope Dealer. And
right.
You know, a question I'm sure a lot of people have is, have you ever been hassled, you know, having a book out there with that title and then, you know, flying around the airports with a case of books like that? Anybody give you a hard time about that?
You know, a couple times the TSA guys who are generally uneducated have stopped me or made light of, you know, actually, like at Oakland Airport, they stopped me one time when I had a case of books, and they were, you know, trying to see if it was an explosive case of books. No, it's just going to blow up your mind, you know. And they pulled it out, and they're like, you know, and the girl behind the counter is like, check this out, this guy's a dope dealer. And her friend there's going, oh, you know, I sold some weed before. I was like, okay, I'm at my home airport here. But, you know, I meant to look at the Federal Register for a while. I think the Center for Cognitive Liberties was posting the reading list of the DEA. They had done a Freedom of Information Act, and just to see what they were buying, what publications they were buying, and I was waiting to show up on that. But I don't know if I ever did, and you know, I never dealt coke or heroin or, you know, any, you know, tonnage of imported products. So maybe I'm, you know, less of a cog in the, you know, I'm in the big economic world of drug dealing. I'm not that kind of a player, and so maybe I'm insignificant in that respect, and or maybe they just don't really care because they're busy. But
well, of course,
unless they're listening. Unless they're listening to this conversation, so they can hear it before they get the podcast. They're not tapping my phone, and I don't really worry about them too much.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter, of course, is that on everything that you've done in the past, the statute of limitations are already run, and so it's really just a free speech issue that we're dealing with here.
That's pretty much the deal. I mean, I wrote by my lawyers before I put it out there, and you know, kind of more just, you know, avoid lawsuits and avoid avoid hassles from the Grateful Dead. That was my one concern, you know, whether I could write the song lyrics down, and their lawyers advised me against it.
But whatever got you into it? How did you wind up being a dope dealer?
Well, the summer of my junior year, it was really dry.
This in college or high school?
In high school.
Uh-huh.
Like, all the weed ran out, and the guy who was selling weed disappeared, and, you know, he was a senior, he graduated, and I like to say he flunked out, but I think he made it. And we tried growing some weed in my friend's backyard, and I was really excited about it, and I was reading a bunch of books, reading what books I could have been, and I sprayed it down with some fish emulsion, hoping to really boost its plant strength, and it killed it. And we smoked these leaves off that plant. They were kind of still had some fish emulsion residue on them, and that just about killed us. And I thought, wow, you know, this is a drag. Somebody's got to do something about this really terrible situation here. And maybe it should be me, because you know, at the time I had my brother was living in Berkeley, and I had been, you know, visiting him in Berkeley and hanging out and smoking pot with his college friends for a couple, a few years. I think I started going down there in seventh grade.
You started early then, right?
Yeah, well, it was just a sort of jaunt, and my parents approved of my, you know, intellectual pursuits. I said, I'm going to go spend the weekend in Berkeley with Dave and go over to Cal, and they thought that was cool, and they didn't really quite understand what was going on over at the infamous Barrington Hall and what a wonderland that would be for a 12-year-old. So some of my elders who have, you know, told me that they were just really, really, you know, paranoid about the idea that they would actually sell me pot, and it was, you know, took a lot of convincing to get them to sell me as a, you know, as a fairly astute teenager. They, you know, they weren't into dealing with any teenagers, but I managed to convince them to sell me some weed, which was far away unimaginably much better than any of the weed anyone had ever seen.
At least it didn't have fish oil on it, huh?
It did not have any nasty residue. It was not paraquatty. You didn't have to worry about that. You know, it was getting the Humboldt when Humboldt first started, and in high school, and that was fantastic. And you know, all of a sudden, I developed a huge community. It became a community service for me to acquire weed and take care of all my friends' weed needs, and develop this rolling, rollicking party that just went nonstop for the year and the years and the years after that.
when you were a senior in high school, then instead of being in one of the homecoming king and the jock, you had your own scene going on there, I take it, huh?
Well, there were stoners. We had cowboys and stoners, too. Ah. You know, there was jocks. And and I sort of crossed the bounds because I was a nerd, you know. I was an intellect. I was at the top of the class. I was doing smart stuff and, you know, captain of the debate team and photographer and a lot of things. So I crossed a lot of boundaries, and it was very interesting for me to be in that position and really be a hub that made a lot of people come together, and we all had a lot of fun and crossed a lot of boundaries with each other, I think, that way. And particularly when my friends convinced me that they wanted to start trying acid too, and a bunch of guys would be dropping acid every week on Friday before class, and it was always an interesting sort of field trip to who was doing what on any given day in my high school.
So now you started smoking cannabis in 7th grade, and 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and yet you're at the top of your class, which, you know, kind of is the opposite of the stereotypes that the war on druggers try to put out there. And so, you know, did you feel that it helped you any, you know, opened you to...
academically?
Well, you know, I'm not necessarily academically, but, you know, as far as did it take down some barriers and allow you to ask questions, explore academically farther than you might have otherwise? You know, you were pretty young then. You know, did it have any objective in your use other than just having a good time?
Well, I certainly, you know, having come from Berkeley, you know, my use, when I first started smoking pot, I was the narc kid at my school. I had studied the drug kit, and I gave presentations to my class on how bad drugs were and how they would do this and that. I mean,
and at the same time, you're selling them?
Well, that's, no, like when I was in 7th grade.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and then, you know, at this point, after, you know, 7th grade, my brother says, hey, you know, I've been smoking pot for years now, you know, maybe you should check it out. And I was just like aghast, you know, at that idea, when everything, you know, that I had been, my indoctrination, the American indoctrination, had told me that the next thing was you were a heroin addict laying in the gutter. And how could this possibly be? And how could these, you know, smart, happening guys be using this evil drug? And so I went and started checking it out. And certainly the kids in 7th grade where I went to school who were smoking pot were smoking dirt, and they were smoking cigarettes and stealing alcohol from their parents and just getting wasted because they were already thrashed. And now they have a better perspective on it. They came from more difficult home situations and were already ground up by the educational industry. And so they were looking for outs. They weren't looking for intellectual experience. I came to it thinking, wow, this is, and was, you know, pretty much indoctrinated by my brother and his friends, the idea that this was an intellectual avenue. So I didn't tell anybody in 7th grade, total secret. I would take my trips to Berkeley. I wouldn't tell anybody that I was smoking pot because they would just, yeah, they thought I was a narc. And so I said, okay, this is the super, you know, this is a good cover for me. And so I was allowed to, you know, carry out my experimentation. And it wasn't until years later, you know, when I went to high school, because I moved right after junior high to a high school where I knew no one. The week before I started my freshman year, I moved to another place. It was just the ruin of my life, and I was disconsolate that I was stuck in this small town.
That's got to be difficult. I know I moved at the beginning of my sophomore year, and it was really devastating to me.
Yeah, all your friends gone, and you have to pick up the pieces. And so you try to find a new social network, and what do you know? Using this particular drug is a socialized ritual.
You're talking about cannabis here, right?
Cannabis.
Yeah.
Using cannabis is a major ritual of youth socialization. And, you know, as a fairly modern phenomenon, but certainly within the 70s context. I remember, you know, my first PE class there in 9th grade, didn't know anybody, and they're picking teams, and the one kid looks at me, he's like, you smoke pot? I was like, in 9th grade? I'm like, yeah? He's like, okay, you're on my team. So all of a sudden, I was on the, you know, I went from being an intellectual, you know, secret stoner to being on the stoner team. But it was, you know, entree into at least making some friends, and eventually making a lot of friends. But, you know, back to the whole intellectual question, I like Mitch Earlywine's book on marijuana statistics and studies. Indicates that students who use marijuana don't do poorly in cognitive measures, but students who have done poorly in school tend to use marijuana more. So the statistics look like students who are doing poorly, you know, that if you use marijuana, you would do poorly. But actually, it's the other way around. If you do poorly, you're looking for an out.
Right.
And smoking pot is a simple way to buzz off.
Well, you know, let's face it, the way our schools are structured, you know, it's pretty boring. You know, I just can't believe the mind-numbing events of high school, you know, and sitting in these classes and not studying what I wanted. Yeah, that they turn out nice little robots, but seems to me like these medicines have kind of broken you out of that. It in the long run, I know there's downsides, but
I wanted an intensive educational program for my kid. You know, he's 3 and he'll be reading pretty soon, and he's learning at some incredibly accelerated pace, because I was faced with the ridiculous question of, oh, am I heading toward the unaffordable choice of private school, or am I going to find out how the brain works from the beginning and realize that your kid can be brilliant if you give him the opportunity,
right,
and you don't choke him down the way that the schools choked me down and everybody else down. And you remove that obstacle, and wow, you can do anything you want. And,
well, you know, I was just talking to Norm Herbert a couple of weeks ago, and he and his wife were two of the people that were extremely instrumental in starting homeschooling curriculum. And I asked him, I said, well, how did you first decide you were going to do this? And he said, well, the day our son came home from his first day in kindergarten, I asked him, what did you learn today? And he said, I learned how to stand in line. And that was the birth of the homeschooling programs.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Which has now been totally co-opted by Jesus people with incredible curriculums of God-invented science books.
Right. I know that that's actually, homeschooling's gotten kind of a bad name through them, but we've got some friends living in Costa Rica who... well, it's been several years since I've seen them, but when their children were 7 and 9, these two young boys, we were as anxious to be around those two boys as around their parents, that they were just really bright kids and fun and interesting and new stuff we didn't know, you know, that it done right, it's really in a marvelous way to educate your kids.
Training, the Institute for the Achievement of Human Potential, which teaches parents to teach their children basically the fact that a child's mind has 1,000 times much more capacity than your old brain does.
Right.
And that if you feed it and don't cheat it by treating it like it's some kind of infant thing, you know, it is the super machine at its peak of capacity. And if you understand how to feed the machine, the results you get will blow your doors in.
Well, you know, it's interesting that we've kind of headed down this track here, because a lot of people think when they hear the word psychedelic that it only has to do with these powerful medicines, but it's really about mind manifesting and these little minds that manifest themselves in these biological avatars we're walking around in. If they all had psychedelic parents, and by that I mean parents who are
open to the mind,
open to helping them expand their minds. Yeah, that what a wonderful world we could have, that, you know?
But it's tremendously frightening, you know, for most people who are sheltered in some way. I mean, at what point is my kid going to know more than me and be asking me questions about things I don't understand? And how am I going to deal with that? And where am I going to send them to, you know, become more informed? Or am I just going to tell them, shut up and watch TV?
Yeah, yeah.
And because that's where I think most people go, it's that, you know, the question of internal chatter and noise that I think most people can't confront, which is why everyone has the music pumping and the TV on all the time, because to sit alone with their own thoughts, let alone psychedelically amplified thoughts, is completely overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, the alcohol and cocaine and television are three good drugs to get you numb and comfortably numb, but the psychedelic medicines are somewhat different in that they're pretty challenging. Not that there isn't pleasure involved, but sometimes I think it's possible to even get uncomfortably high sometimes. That ever happened to you? Ever have any ultimate highs? Yeah.
Just about, half of my life. Yeah. And it's funny because now I've kind of come to a point where the idea of using psychedelics is more about work. And particularly if I were thinking about going into some sort of deep state. It's to challenge myself and work through stuff, not to be seeking the flashing, glittering lights of pleasure. although there's always the opportunity for incredible pleasure in those places, that's usually not what I'm thinking if I were to venture in that direction, because chasing the idea of pleasure for as long as I did using psychedelics and being blasted constantly by all of my psychological material that I was not prepared to observe or comment on or appreciate or work with made me sort of, burnt out on that recreational style of light chasing, as it were. In fact, at Burning Man, I was like, wow, is this what I want to be doing, wandering around looking at flashing lights? Although there was someone's assembly of flashing lights there that was truly amazing and probably would have been stunning to look at in a psychedelic state, and I'm sure it was for thousands of people there.
You're talking about the Cubitron?
The Cubitron.
Yeah. And, yeah. Interestingly, like you, and I don't know why I even decided to do this, but this year, like you, I had no substance of any kind, including alcohol, and did it on the Natch, and it's really an interesting experience that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you can't appreciate art in your normal state. For me, what I've learned, and particularly talking to a lot of the elders in the psychedelic community, the therapeutic communities, and particularly working with people in the shamanic context, and what I was saying about tripping was that of all the amazing and unbelievable things that you could see out on the playa while you were high on whatever you were high on, if you laid down on the dirt, shut your eyes and put on a mask so you couldn't see anything but the inside of your mind for however many hours you were amplified, you would see 1,000 times more incredible visions, and you would also be able to interpret the archetypal much more clearly than if it were being projected onto your external reality. And I think that is where I sort of lost track, and with my book, I'm going through trip after trip after trip where I'm amplifying my paranoid visions, which are really projections of my internal discomfort onto my external reality. So I can no longer trust what I'm seeing in these amplified states because I'm not sitting down and dealing with what is pouring out of my mind.
Let me ask you a question here. How many years since you first started in seventh grade? I don't know how old you are because I've known you forever, it seems like, but I know you're not nearly as old as I am. But about how many years would you consider were like really kind of intensive tripping years before you've gotten to this point where now you see it in a little different light, more that, wow, I'm going to have to do some work if I go ahead and do this. And how many years were you a serious psychedelic user before you kind of shifted gears from the pure pleasure part into the hard work part?
That real intense period of my youth where I went from tripping every week to tripping every other day in the course of a few years really kind of scarred me. And after that, after a certain while, I realized I didn't have to trip at every dead show, and my tripping went down to, every couple months or something, but intensified in, I kept raising the scale of what I'd be doing so that, trying to smash through my own barriers. After having read LSD psychotherapy, I decided that I needed to just keep taking higher doses so that I would, break through my ego structure, my solidified ego structure. And so I was doing you know, what were fairly large doses, you know, 1,000 mic doses here and there, and not too frequently, but, you know, constantly just, you know, car crashing them. And, and so at a certain point, I just had to quit. I came to the point where I just, like, I couldn't, you know, I was overwhelmed by my own fear of what I would, you know, either wind up as or, you know, what kind of accident would befall me if I were to keep tripping. And I took 10 years off before I sat down to write my book. Because, you know, while my book is sort of a little behind the times on what drugs everybody's using and, you know, where people are at, because I missed the entire Palenque Revolution and the, you know, Terrence lecture tour and, you know, the whole, I think, formation of the new psychedelic culture. I was training in meditation and Chinese medicine and other things to sort of restore myself to the place where I would be most functional.
Well, you know, it's really fascinating to hear you tell this story because I remember when I first met Terrence McKenna, it was pretty late in his career. He only had a couple years to live. I think it was summer of 98. And I remember at the time him saying something to the effect that he only tripped very, very seldom anymore. And that came at a time when I was really at a peak level of doing it real frequently, like you were talking about, daily and being way out there and thinking, wow.
You? You're like the most grounded, straightest guy I've ever met. Like.
Well, I've had my moments, you know.
Okay.
And at the time I was thinking, wow, you know, God, I'm older than him, and he's just kind of, you know, easing back now. And then I started meeting, because, see, I got a late start at this whole thing.
You look at the places he'd been already.
Right, exactly.
You know,
see,
how
and
much higher can you get?
He'd already been there, and I was just, you know, I was 42 years old before I got started in this whole thing. And so now it's 22 years later, and all of a sudden, you know, not all of a sudden, a few years back, all of a sudden, it was like a switch was thrown. I thought, wow, you know, I've had, I don't know how many countless experiences, and, you know, I just got to take a breath here. And I've noticed this in a lot of people that I know now, that somewhere around the 10 to 15 year mark, if you're serious about being a psychedelic person, that you get a point where you say, okay, now I've got to really get serious, and each one of these make it count. And that's sort of the what I'm getting out of what you were saying. And
yeah.
You know, I've come to the same conclusion, and yet I want to be careful that I don't come across saying, you know, everybody should cut back, et cetera. You know, it's maybe a way these things, we've evolved to use them, in that we have to kind of overwhelm ourselves. You know, I'm not saying there's a right way or a wrong way, because I don't have a clue, but in my case, as long as you keep yourself healthy and don't get any real risky situations, you can live through some high doses like this and then come out on the bright side.
Yes, leaping across mountaintops, no doubt.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is, it's what I was looking at and doing research for lectures and kind of studying drug history and the whole whole cultural connection to drugs is so alcohol-based that the only way that we think about drug use, besides going to the doctor and taking a drug to make you better, which is not the way we think about medicines, because those are drugs, not medicines, is to get completely fucked up. We drink alcohol, we binge drink alcohol to get wasted, unless we're, you know, old moderates. and when we meet up with a drug, we say, ah, it's a drug, let's get wasted. And the drugs are so astronomically more powerful and completely different than alcohol that all of a sudden you have completely lost your axis, and it can be fantastic and wonderful to be, you know, blasted open like that. But I've come to the what I call a third eye program, which is intention. You have to have an intention for using medicine, something you're seeking, some information you're seeking. The final key is integration. And if you don't integrate your experiences, if you don't take the time to integrate each one of your experiences and spend the time, because it can take you months and even years to catch up with what the information really was that you were being handed during that trip, then you haven't really grasped the value of it. And that's criminal. It's a tremendous loss of the potential that you have in using that medicine. And I think that's what the judicious and certainly the shamanistic perspective is going to be. Middle I that I forgot about there was the one we talked about already, internalization. You can't really gather information that well if you're wandering down the boulevard.
Right.
Tripping in Vegas is pretty fucking amazing. I've done it. It's got to be done. But when you're finally back, down, was it all about the moving carpet and the wheels spinning around and the lights flashing, or was there something talking to you that you missed? That's your third eye theory of tripping. It's intention, internalization, and integration. So you intend to go somewhere, you shut your eyes and turn off the noise, the externals, and go inside your mind for the information. And then you take however long it takes you to complete the journey by integrating the information that you got. That can take a while. When you get blown across the galaxy, sometimes it takes a while to fit it in. I may be catching up right now with a trip I had 20 years ago where I had astronomic open heart surgery and my heart was replaced by a sun from another galaxy, which made me feel really bad because I felt like, wow, I'm just such one cold, dead fuck that my heart is burnt out already at 25 and I need to be replaced with a sun from another galaxy. I better do something useful in my life to have cost the universe a whole sun to keep me alive.
That sounds like an interesting trip. Was that a high-dose acid, or what was that?
Yeah, that was a very high-dose acid. And yes, near death, freezing in the wilderness in the middle of winter.
Do you have any specific techniques that you use to try to bring information back? Like, for example, when I do my some of my solo journeys, I take a little tape recorder with me and just record things as I go. And of course, it'd be nonsensical to most normal people, but I can play things back and bring back the visuals and a whole lot of information that from trips years ago.
Of your tapes.
Well, they wouldn't mean anything to you, but do you have any do you take notes?
I got one of those little recorders now, and actually I find that those little things flash upon me all the time. But I usually take a book.
Mm-hmm.
I usually take a notebook. A friend of mine convinced me a long time ago. I take a notebook and write stuff down. I'm not as big on drawing mandalas, but sometimes I will have to craft something. But usually I'll take a notebook with me if I'm going and if I have some questions. But on the way in, in directing yourself, I've taken up a couple of practices of visualization techniques, different meditative techniques. Sometimes I work with some divinatory practices where you would seek information from some kind of mythic character or place, or ask to meet elders or power beings to give you information to retreat through your own personal history or ask for doorways to appear to present you with information. But most of those have to do with doing a certain amount of stilling the mind at a certain point so that you can engage in that process. And that certainly benefits your ability to, you know, get the information and pull it back.
Yeah, I think all those are good ideas. The other day I was talking to Gary Fisher, and he said, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s when they were doing a lot of research, that they never did a session without a sitter. And so they always had a sitter in the room with them. Which is not a way I go about it, but he was telling some of the more funny LSD stories from his experiences, which there are many. And he said one time he was the subject and had taken a high dose and had a sitter there, and the sitter was just off on the side, just, you know, reading or something like that. And Gary said all of a sudden he had this really important flash, and he told his sitter to get paper and pencil. He had this real revelation that he wanted him to write down. And the message was, Gary, never take this stuff again. And he couldn't figure out why the sitter was laughing at him. But I've been there.
Yeah. Some days that is the message, you know. And that's, you know, it's kind of one of the things I wound up looking at a lot in both my meditation training and my Chinese medicine training, is that I have had a lot of serious injuries and accidents. And I think from an early age, I was really into, I don't know, want to skydive and do things that were involved throwing my body off of anything possible. And I've always had this sort of desire to transcend my body, to leave my body and fly off. And after smashing my body into the pavement enough times, and injuring it seriously enough doing so, I kind of came to the appreciation of the fact that I have this body in this lifetime, and it's kind of groovy. It's a, you know, theoretically, it's a really lucky thing to have a body, and to live in my body for this lifetime, it's extremely valuable to me. And all the time I'm chasing these super conscious experiences, these stratospheric highs, I'm generally leaving my body behind and, you know, leaving it in the dirt somewhere while I'm off tripping around the galaxy. And I think there was a certain sense of disconnection from my body that came from that chase. And I think my body kept reminding me, by running itself into walls and things, that I'm here in this physical body, and I have this life to live in this body, and to stay here. Use these experiences to benefit this life and be aware of things. But, you know, living in trip land isn't necessarily beneficial. It's hard for me to say it's not, you know, it's not an evil, you know, I don't have anything against it, but I think that it's important to, you know, be with your body.
Well, you know, that's interesting to hear you say that, because I was just sitting here thinking that people who have never had a psychedelic experience would most likely say, hey, this is pretty obvious, you know, but that most of the people listening to these podcasts have had the great good fortune to have a few of these experiences. And once you have, then what you're saying really resonates on a totally different level. And I would be surprised if most of our listeners didn't also have had some kind of experiences like that. I know I have myself.
Yeah.
So, Well, listen, we're about out of time here, but and I want to do this again because I got a lot more questions. But
yeah,
we didn't even go
over any of the questions we had.
I know. we'll save those for another one. It's just been fun talking with you. But you know, before we go, I don't know if you want to, but we got a couple of minutes. Do you care to mention anything about the what I would call, I guess, psychic house cleaning that you do?
Oh, actually, I was meant to say, you know, I meant to give myself a plug. I always do these things and forget to give myself a plug and say, hey, people, if you want to read about any of my insanity, my book, Confessions of a Dope Dealer, is available through my website, SheldonNorberg.com, signed for me, or you can get it. And I recommend people use the Arrowhead link to Amazon because, you know, I don't really support Amazon, but if you're going to give Amazon less money for my book than you would pay me, use Arrowhead's click-through so that they get money out of it.
And I agree. Help Arrowhead any way you can. Those people
are
just the best.
They are so good for everyone. But, yeah, I'm working on a new book now, and I think I'm just another, you know, couple weeks from a contract on my book, on my really weird job. It was a long time I didn't talk to people about my work as a drug dealer. And certainly, I had to keep that secret for most of my life, but you know, from many people. But my work as a psychic house cleaning guy, I certainly always felt very nervous about talking about, because it as insane as I may have become taking psychedelics at some at any period, I can always still present myself as rational. Adult, and once you cross the line and say, yeah, I work in houses where people have ghosts from people who've been murdered and died of cancer, or other really unbelievably strange things happening from energetic situations that aren't related to somebody dying and aren't related to bizarre phenomenon. Then you have to really wonder about your own sanity and the sanity of anyone who agrees with you. But apparently, what I do working on people's houses that have
where things go bump in the night, shall we say?
Things go more than bump in the night, and the energy is somewhat toxic to them, to the people living there. It's been a very interesting practice that I've been working on for the last dozen years or so, and I would like to say it's the kind of most interesting job I could find after selling acid. you need an interesting job after that. So after having developed my meditation practice, I sort of stumbled into this field and really developed my own practice, which I am writing this book about, which, you know, it looks like a really good book, which interestingly enough has, you know, 100 times the marketability than a drug book, because everyone is so afraid of drug books, except for people who are upfront about their drug use. And while everyone is concerned about having the anti-rational finger pointed at them, they certainly are interested in odd phenomena. And this book certainly catalogs pretty much the range of what might be going on in your house if it has something weird going on, and how you might want to think about that.
Well, I definitely have some personal experience in that line, in that years ago I was living in a house that was it had a bad hold on me, and I was having difficulty extracting myself, so I actually invented my own little ceremony. And you know, the old cult I was raised in, called the Catholic Church, had given me at least an idea of ceremony. And so what I did is I went around the house, and instead of using the holy water that I'd been taught, I got even holier water, which was my bong water, and did a ceremony
wow.
and released that spirit from the house, and I got out of there myself. So it was a little improvised ceremony, but in the future, I would prefer to call an expert like you, and we'll put links up on our website from when I podcast this to some of your sites and your book, and so people can get in touch with you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic thing, is that, you know, we forget about how powerful we are and how powerful ritual is and how powerful our minds are. And certainly, I on the really gnarly jobs that I get, I wouldn't recommend that anybody do them themselves, but for most everyone, it's important to set up their sacred space and use their ritual space and their intentions to create their life. And, you know, the place you live is your sacred space, or it's just some place you're passing through.
Well, you're exactly right there, that every place you be and live should be your sacred space, and turn this world into the paradise it's meant to be. Huh?
So. All right.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you spending time with us here today, and we'll definitely have to do this again in the not-too-distant future, and that way we don't have to worry about doing these things on the plyo when there are other things to do than record podcasts, right?
You feel like keep the dust out of your teeth.
Right. Well, listen, you have a wonderful week, and thank you again for everything. I really appreciate this, Sheldon.
Always great talking to you, Lorenzo, and the salon is a great service to our community and to our future community.
Well,
so.
We're happy to have you here in with us, and look forward to the next time. So you be well, Sheldon, you hear?
Thank you, sir.
Take care now. Bye-bye. Well, there you have the first of our Psychedelic Salon phone interviews. As you might have guessed, Sheldon and I never really got to the questions we planned on covering in the interview. Instead, we just kind of had one of our normal conversations. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, mainly because we plan on doing it again. And I'll try to let you know ahead of time when I'm planning on recording one of these interviews, and then maybe you can email me with some of your own questions for our guests. It's an attempt of some kind to make these conversations a little more interactive with all of us out there in cyberdelic space. And speaking of being a little more interactive, I do want to thank all of you who sent me your comments via email. And after listening to several podcasts from The Dope Fiend and from Queer Ninja, I can see that I've been remiss in not commenting on your emails here in the podcast from time to time. But that certainly doesn't mean that I don't really appreciate it when I get notes like the one I got from John in the UK the other day, who wrote to say that he was just listening to Rupert Sheldrake's explanation of the different states of creativity at different states of temperature, and he ended by saying, "Wow, absolutely fascinating." And I completely agree with you, John. And isn't it interesting to hear how Terrence McKenna picked up on that, and then he went off on a riff of his own about the cooling down of things. You know, listening to the interplay of these great minds, like you say, is absolutely fascinating. And Meredith, I tried to answer your email, and I said, "Thanks for the kind words. I'm glad you are enjoying them as much as I am." But I got a message back that said, "Your mailbox is currently unavailable, and to please contact correspondent directly." So I guess this is as directly as is possible, but hey, thanks again for your kind words. I really do appreciate them. And one thing, another thing that came up the other day was a suggestion that came from old Joe, who said that he thought we should have some coffee mugs made up with the Psychedelic Salon's logo on them. And I had to tell him that it probably wouldn't be too great of an idea to have a coffee mug at work with the word psychedelic on it. But he came back and said he didn't have to be that obvious, but of course neither one of us could come up with any good ideas for one. So I'll leave that idea up to you artists out there. If any of you want to submit ideas for a logo at the Psychedelic Salon, well, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com, and I'll post them on our website, and hopefully we can get some feedback about them. Or maybe this is just another idea whose time has not yet come. I guess we'll just have to wait and see about it. Oh, and one last thing before I go. I got a really great email from Tim, who's way up there in Newfoundland. At least it seems like it's way up there to me, way down here in Southern California. But anyway, Tim brought up a couple of points that I thought might be worth clearing up. One has to do with the number of podcasts I've done from the Psychedelic Salon so far, and maybe some of you can help me here. This podcast you're listening to right now is the 64th in the series, and the podcasts that are shown on the RSS feed are only about the last 20 or so. And my problem is that no one seems to have a really good answer about what to do when these RSS listings start getting really long. You know, should I include all 64 podcasts on the feed? And then what happens when the number gets over 100? And my thinking has been I ought to set up archives, say in groups of 25, and have a separate feed for each group, and then just keep this main feed that you're subscribed to right now as always having the most recent 25 programs on it. But I'm wide open to any ideas that any of you might have as to how to handle this. And again, if you do, send them to me, lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. And the other issue that Tim brought up is kind of a dicey one, I guess, and that has to do with why I've never played any talks by Tim Leary. And here I know I'm going to piss off quite a few of my friends, most of whom are major Leary supporters, but personally I'm kind of ambivalent about Leary. You know, I can argue both sides of his case and convince myself that he was both really good for the psychedelic community and on the other side that he was its worst enemy. But I've made my decision to not podcast any of his work based not only on my own opinions about him, but also on the opinions of two friends of mine who both had close relationships with Leary during the 60s. And in the future, I hope to get more into this, but until I get both of their remembrances recorded and podcast, I'm going to hold back on lectures by the good Dr. Leary, or or St. Tim, as many of you like to call him. So, Tim, Newfoundland Tim, that is, that's at least part of your answer. As for Ram Dass and Dr. Hoffman, well, my wife actually has quite a few Ram Dass lectures on tape, but they all have copyright notices on them, and I simply don't have the time to try and track down the recording companies to ask for permission. So if any of you out there in cyberdelic space happen to have a recording or two that you made at a Ram Dass lecture, I'd love to have a copy to podcast here in the Psychedelic Salon. And Tim also mentioned Dr. Hoffman. Well, you might be in luck there, as long as you speak German, that is. I think I've got a copy of one of his talks at his 100th birthday celebration, and if I can find it, I'll tag it on to the end of a future podcast for you German speakers to enjoy. Well, there's a lot more I'd like to get into today, but if I'm going to get this podcast out yet tonight, I'd better sign off for now. My next podcast, by the way, will hopefully be out by the end of this week, and it'll be the first side of the next tape in the Trialogue series. That tape's titled Chaos in the Imagination. And thanks again to Chateau Hayuk for the use of their music here in the Psychedelic Salon. And a special thank you to all of you guys out there in cyberdelic space. It's really amazing how many of us there are who are being interconnected through this podcast and through other interconnecting programs like some of my favorites, the Sea Realm, and then all of those podcasts from dopecast.co.uk, where you can hear Dope Fiend and Xandor and Queer Ninja and all of who, all of those guys. Gee, they produce some really top-notch programs. And I did put up links to them on our podcast page, which is at www.matrixmasters.com/podcasts, in case you want to check them out. I don't think you'll be disappointed. I know I'm really enjoying going back and listening to all of their old programs. So check out KMO, The Dope Fiend, Xandor, and Queer Ninja. And if you get a chance, please do stop back by here for the next podcast from the Psychedelic Salon. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.